Hello and welcome to another San Diego Political Podcast from BolosS.com. I'm Matthew Bowler. This time, Rick Epps and I sat down with the president of the San Diego Police Officers Association, Brian Marvel. We spent about an hour, a little over an hour, chatting about the San Diego Police Department, their role in our community as officers, as a department, their mayoral endorsement, why they endorsed whom they did, and how the POA sees itself when compared to other labor organizations, like Service Employees International Union, SEIU, for example. Also, we spent a fair amount of time talking about pensions. I also have to make a quick apology for a technical issue. My mic died right at the moment we started recording, and I did a lot to fix my audio so that you could be understood. There were a lot of other mics there to pick up my audio. Brian and Rick both sound perfect. However, I have a bit of an echo, but I think it's totally listenable and definitely worthwhile listening to. Just want to let you know so you wouldn't think there was something wrong with your phone or your computer, however it is you happen to be listening to this. Brian was great. He's a super friendly guy, and like almost all the cops I've met, he's a great conversationalist. So, San Diego's POA on BolosS.com. Remember, you want to jump up on your political soapbox, you can do that by jumping on ours, called the BolosS.com Political Podcast Soapbox, and leave a message, 619-663-4531, 619-663-4531. Remember to listen, share, retweet. Brian Marvel, President, San Diego's Police Officers Association, BolosS.com.
We have a program called the Institute on Global and World Affairs, and we brought in the secretary of Navy at the time. And you would have thought you would have seen a guy walk in with, you know, full regalia and all the medals and stuff, you know. And I'm from a military, and I tell you why he walked in. He was business suit. You would have thought he's a businessman.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not at all what you would think of in terms of like coming into the, you know. I mean, he literally looked like he came out of the Harvard Business School or something.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, but just low key demeanor. Just, it was pretty interesting. I mean, that's what's changing also in the police department too.
Absolutely.
You know, they're much more. It's much more political and you know, more it's a business it's a business like. Oriented.
Well, that's like our. You know, we're really trying to monitor the level of a candidate we're receiving. Because, you know, law enforcement, I look at law enforcement as quasi blue collar, white collar. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you're actually working out in the streets and stuff like that, it's real blue collar. You got to be hands on, you got to be able to do that. Yeah. But, you know, as you expand your career and knowledge base, you know, there are opportunities to clearly move into more of a white collar type of law enforcement, you know, investigations. Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, like our.
So early on, you're more like you're more like a jock.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you kind of learn more what's going
absolutely.
On, and then you kind of stop doing that.
Right.
Because you don't need to, right?
Right. And there's guys who want to stay blue collar.
Yeah.
You know, and. You know, they want to be in patrol. They spend their whole lives in patrol because that's what they enjoy. They enjoy talking to people, enjoy solving problems, dealing with issues on the street, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. And then you have a group of people who want to get into more of the, you know what, I really want to get in on investigations and I want to learn how to solve crimes and homicides and rapes mm-hmm. and child abuse and stuff like that. So from their perspective, they're more at a desk, conducting interviews, and occasionally you get some of the high-speed stuff of, you know, you get to serve a warrant or try to arrest somebody. But, you know, like our economics crimes unit guys, those guys are literally, they're at a desk trying to crack how somebody stole your identification based off of the leads that they have.
Yeah.
So that's more of, you know what, they need a skill set and an ability to reason.
Yeah. You got to do the analysis. You got to do stats.
Yep.
Stats person. It's amazing how isn't it interesting how much it's changed. Even that part of
the police work, you don't think. You think, oh, well, there's a cop.
Yep.
You know, with a club.
Yeah. Where's Barnaby Jones?
Stop that guy.
I know.
Barnaby. A crime.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but it's not. You know.
Yeah.
But there's different.
But even like
you look at like Ironside, for example, because that's the new show I've hooked up.
Oh, yeah. So I remember the first one.
Me too.
I have Hulu, so I can. They put all the whole first one up, too. So you can go back and I started watching that one, too. It's just interesting to see the difference.
Yeah.
But even there, they're sort of interpreting that guy is still as kind of a tough guy. He's got these smart people, and he's smart. His character's smart, but they're all still tough guys, right?
Yeah.
And that is kind of, I think, misleading in a lot of ways to what real police work is. Because, right, most of real police work happens between your ears. Right?
Yeah.
And
I always wonder, how do you communicate that to a community that has a preconceived notion it's about what cops are supposed to be?
I took a crime report down at Point Loma. Used to be one of my beats that I worked in. Mm-hmm. This lady's house got burglarized, and she was watching CSI or some other high tech show. And you know, when it comes to fingerprints out in the field, I'm not a lab tech specialist. They have the ability to pull fingerprints from a lot of stuff that a regular patrol officer necessarily can. And it was like, I was telling this lady the way this wood was, and I was like, I can't pull the print off of that. And she's like, well, I just saw on TV the FBI pulled a fingerprint off a dead body. And I'm like, I don't even know if that's real, but the reality, I go, that, you know, they have that kind of specialty. And I go, you know, I told her, I had to break the news. I go, unfortunately, this is a burglary to a house. It's low level. The resources aren't there for me to call a lab tech out to pull a fingerprint, even if we could pull a fingerprint off. I mean, we can pull fingerprints off of a lot of stuff and footprints and stuff like that. But I go, I don't have the resources, and I can tell you my department's not going to send this out on something like this. But you're right. People watch these shows, and they honestly believe this stuff can be done. It translates to the real world.
Well, that's a dangerous part on both sides. I mean, it's dangerous because the unrealistic expectations of the public.
Yep.
And also, it's also, though, about how you teach criminals. You give criminals ideas, too. And I think that's one of the parts I think is very slippery slope in this, is that, you know, a lot of guys who get to fall, who go down that path, see this stuff, and they get an idea off something they've seen on TV, and you're going, you know, sometimes the media can be a little bit irresponsible in terms of, you know.
Yeah, but it's fiction, and the weird thing is people can't tell the difference.
Well, now today, particularly, who can tell the difference between what's real and what's not real?
Right,
I mean, I grew up with Leave It to Beaver, so you had at least a father knows best, so you had a sort of notion of what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
But now there's sort of this blurred edge between, and even in society, which puts a lot of pressure in the department, you know.
Yeah. It does.
Now, I'll give you a good example. In my class, San Diego State, we do a segment on just sort of social issue stuff. And, you know, we talk about the police and talk about how many of you feel comfortable, you know, when the police officer drives up to you, do you feel like, oh, look, there's Officer Jones, and I feel okay.
Yeah, what am I doing?
Or do you have what I call the OSM, the old shit moment?
Yeah,
where, you know, and it's like, and yet the society says to protect and serve, right? And yet the idea, but people are really afraid. People are afraid of police. And it's, to me, that's, it's an unfortunate thing, because, I mean, I know a lot of police officers, so it's, for me, I understand there's a lot of good guys out there. Yep. There's also some people out there who have other issues, too. I mean, it's just reality. You can't.
I know, you have to agree with it. I mean, we recruit from the general public, and you hope that you can get the right people through the process.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, certain individuals get through the process, and it's across all spectrums.
It's a big corporation. It's a big entity. You're not talking like 200. I mean, that would be small, 200.
Right.
I mean, Philadelphia has, I think I was hearing, Philadelphia has like 2,400.
They probably need more. They probably need another 2,400.
6,000 cops, and they're about the same size as San Diego.
Yeah.
San Diego has
1,800.
Wow.
And still, 1,800 people. 1,800 individuals is a lot of people. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and that's still understaffed
Considerably understaffed for a city the size of San Diego.
You know, you really have to look at law enforcement as an East Coast, West Coast thing. The East Coast. You know, I don't know if the criminals are different, but the way the branches, the law enforcement handles it, like on the East Coast, they are very, they have police officers that do a lot of work that on the West Coast, out of an abundance of efficiency, doing things a little bit smarter. We don't necessarily need police officers doing a lot of the work. Like, we have volunteers here that help us out a lot, but we have the investigative aides who are civilians, they're not police officers. On the East Coast, those would all be cops. Okay. Where we have recognized that, do we really need a police officer sitting at a desk processing a parking ticket?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
That can be done by a civilian at a lower rate.
Why do you think that is?
I just think that law enforcement developed a certain way on the East Coast, and it's been very difficult to break through the way they handle law enforcement there, as opposed to here where, you know, our law enforcement really came about in the late 1800s, where they were there since the 1600s. Yeah. So,
when was it was really, a lot of it was private, though. There wasn't a lot of publicly paid officers until the end of the 19th, just after Civil War.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
They were all
like Pinkertons.
Yeah, Pinkerton.
You know? Well, you had the sheriffs.
Yeah, the sheriffs
who then would deputize.
Yeah.
Very small, you know, it'd be a sheriff, maybe a couple deputies, and that would it. And then they created posses, you know.
Kind of as was needed.
As needed,
even
absolutely.
In the big urban areas.
Absolutely,
like
you bet.
Boston. Yeah.
So if you look for, on the West Coast, the closest East Coast police department would be San Francisco.
Yeah. It's an older city. Yeah.
It's an older city. A lot of the northern people came to San Francisco for the gold rush. They established it. Yeah. So you
it's
look,
also a city that's also a real San Diego's not really, I mean, it's a city. It's not really a city. I mean, it really isn't. I mean, I'm from here like you are. Yeah. It's just not a city.
It's like a group of hamlets.
Yeah, that have all been sort of tied together. It's sort of, but San Francisco is a metropolitan area, an urban area that really resonates within the confines of that small area. Mm-hmm. So you can see the little difference there.
Yeah.
One of the things I was going to share with you was, I mean, I grew up out in Lemon Grove, La Mesa area, and I remember, and I understand one of the complexities for the police department is the changing demographics.
Right.
When I was a kid growing up, Lemon Grove was a very, they didn't have, I mean, occasionally they'd have a petty theft and robbery occasionally, but there was no violent crime out there at all, ever, hardly. It was just dead. You could leave your houses open. I mean, people rode horses on the streets. And now Lemon Grove is like, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of, I mean, the cops have gotten harder. They didn't used to be like that when I was growing up. I was a patrol boy. They all hung out and waved at us and talked to us. And, now it's just, and La Mesa is the same way. 70th El Cajon Boulevard was a quiet little sleepy area in the 70s, you know, and now it's like prostitution and drugs and all kinds of stuff in that. So the demographics have changed, which also means that, and the problems have changed, which have changed your job.
Right.
I would think I bet one of the toughest things you have to deal with in the department is the changing demographics and what that means on a social level for your intervention.
Yeah, and, you know, with the reduction and downsizing of our police department, we've had to, you know, we were really known for the community-oriented policing in the late 90s and early 2000s. We've actually had to move away from that, which I think we're still trying to do the best we can in that regards. But the reality is, if we had the staffing numbers, we could probably get more into the community-oriented. See, you know, the police department considers there's 123 neighborhoods in the city of San Diego.
Yeah.
So when you have that, you want to break it up to where you have officers that are only dealing with maybe one or two neighborhoods so they can get a better feel and get in touch with the people that actually live in that area, where now, because we've had to reduce it, you'll have one officer who will literally cover, you know, maybe 15 or 20 neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And that's a big – it's big.
Yeah.
It may not be so much in certain areas like in the Rancho Bernardo area or maybe over here in Claremont. But when you start to really get into the mid-city areas where you start to get a lot of the cultural differences, you get the Somalis.
Yeah, 40, 50th Street.
Those are very dynamic and very separate groups, although they live in the same area.
Yeah.
You know, you got the Vietnamese there, you got some of the Hmongs, you got the Somalis and stuff.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for one officer to handle all of that when it was better if you had several officers dealing with those communities.
Well, plus then you have mixed in with that also the gangs problem that is shooting over there by High Tech High, the Health Science Society of the day.
I mean,
you know, just it's like, so in the midst of all that, you've still got drug problems, you've got... And so as the demographic becomes much more dangerous, which also puts a lot of pressure on the police department to figure out, how do you know whether the person you're coming to say hello to is a person who's, you know, a threat to you or not?
Right.
And then that's an age-old struggle for police officers.
Yeah,
right?
it is.
And I think that's an interesting point to be made, though. I mean, in terms of the, you know, in fact, you made a point earlier about the idea of, like, you have some civilianized people who do some of the work now.
Mm-hmm.
Has the department ever thought about having some of those people be like community outreach people?
Oh, we do. We have a Mid-City is the one of the largest community centers. Is staffed by mostly civilians.
Oh, okay.
Great. There's a couple cops in there.
Yeah.
It's a very specific need community. So we have, unfortunately, we had a Somali police officer in our department. He went out on an injury recently, which really hurt us. Yeah. It's like you want to recruit folks from those communities. Yeah. And then, I mean, the bad part is you want to recruit them, but they may not necessarily want to work there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And the department tries to, like, hey, you know, this might be a really good fit for you, but, you know, say they want to work in Ocean Beach or PB. Yeah. It's a little bit more exciting. It's different for them. But the department's like, you know, it'd be really nice if you come over here, but they really can't do that because, yeah, you know, you don't want to stifle somebody.
Yeah. You also have an easier time getting, like, you know, white guys
absolutely, yeah,
sign up to be cops a
yeah
lot more than other.
Our hardest recruit right now is a female African American.
Really?
It is so hard to get them to want to join the police force, and we literally spend a lot of resources on trying to draw them into the police force to be a cop.
You guys reach out to high? Do you guys go to high schools and
we
start?
We do, yeah.
Like,
yeah, we're actually, I have to give credit to LAPD. They actually have a magnet school,
mm-hmm,
that is actually, some of the instructors there are cops.
Oh, wow.
The police department supports the school.
Yeah.
A lot of the teachers there are cops. They a real big focus on law enforcement,
yeah,
to get to these kids at an early age to go, look, being a police officer is not a bad thing. We need folks from a broad spectrum of backgrounds to come, mm-hmm, be police officers, bring your,
mm-hmm,
what you were brought and raised up into the police department so we get that diversification we need to get out into the community so,
yeah,
those community members trust us and are willing to work with us. That's why when I go out and I talk about the amount of officers that are retiring, and you're probably well aware of this, mm-hmm, when those folks leave, they take with them everything they've got.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've built up all these relationships in the, mm-hmm, community, and because the department doesn't have the ability to backfill and send this person, hey, spend several months with this officer,
yeah,
to learn who he's talking to and communicate with them so they build that trust.
Yeah.
When he leaves, you're starting from scratch. And the reason we solve a lot of our high-profile crimes, you know, some rapes, murders, gang stuff,
mm-hmm,
is because these officers get a tip from one of their friends.
Yeah.
Who then they go to homicide and say, hey, you know what? You may want to look into this. I got a tip from an anonymous person,
yeah,
who wants to remain anonymous for various reasons.
Exactly.
And homicide looks at it. Next thing you know, it leads them onto a trail of who the suspect may be.
You, yeah, lose institutional knowledge.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people, yeah, I think a lot of companies make that mistake.
Yeah.
When they get rid of their older employees, they,
yeah,
don't value,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they don't value
right
knowledge.
Yeah.
You see that happening. Kind of,
yeah, it's an intangible. How do you put a dollar amount on that?
Yeah, well, I mean that's
could
the thing. I mean,
well,
the thing,
you
know, is, it should
can
be though, because I mean,
right,
the people,
you know,
who are leaving, there should. I mean, some of them are leaving because they want, they're ready to go on to the other things. Other people leave because they either can't afford or they're burned out or whatever.
But there
should be a vehicle or a method by which these people who've served these years can go into another portion of the department and still be able to have, you know, it's almost like, or I use the analogy I'll use is this: the quarterback. In the old days, the quarterback who was like John Unitas and these guys, the proteges became behind them. They just they tutored them, right?
Right.
And then when the guys like John Elway and Dan Marino, these guys come in, they leave. They're not helping the kids behind them
right
anymore.
Yeah.
So the guys coming in at 28, 22, 23 years old don't have any mentors ahead of them anymore.
Yeah.
And like, it'd be great if the old guys could take some of the young guys, get them sort of introduced to their friends, and you know, who helps them. But that doesn't happen anymore because we're all leaving.
Yeah.
And that becomes a real problem.
And that was, you know, I mean, that's a really good analogy because back in the days in football,
yeah,
the starting quarterback, there was that backup quarterback.
Yeah.
You knew that backup quarterback was going to be the next quarterback.
Yeah.
You know, so you sort of wanted to see him get in some games when it was like a blowout just to get him tested. But
hey, look,
right,
I played at UCLA, and I'll tell you, our backup quarterback, we didn't want to see him in the game.
No.
Sorry, Steve.
Were you there with Troy Aikman?
No. Yeah, you got another almost 10 years
earlier. 10 years before
almost
that.
Almost 10 years before that. 9 years before that.
All right.
Six. Let's say six.
Yeah. Six. There
you go. Give or take a day or two, yeah.
Exactly.
But it's interesting because it really does, I think that, you know, I mean, I did a couple of ride-alongs when I was growing up. And I won't mention any of the officers' names, but just really great guys. And I had, and you're right about the relationship thing. One of the officers was with, we had a guy who was on PCP, and we had a, what they call, I'll use the term, 1087. I thought, I could have swore I was like Starsky and Hutch in the car. and the funny thing about it was so they called him, but he knew the guy, knew his father, got the guy's father down there, didn't take him to jail, got him, you know. I mean, it could have gone really bad because the guy was trying to really, was getting aggressive, right? And,
yeah.
And, but because of that relationship he had,
yep.
He was able to deal with that without, you know, coming to something that could have been very, yeah. very serious. I mean, it could have gotten really serious really fast because PCP, they're like Superman. Yeah.
They are. Yeah. It's been in a couple fights and it was yeah. just unbelievable.
Yeah, how these little skinny, scrawny guys yep. turn into like the Hulk, but they're not yeah. physically, they're just, you know.
And that's the problem we run into because you'll see, like you said, this super ultra skinny guy.
Yeah.
And there's like six or seven cops on him and they're like, man, they were beating the crap out of him. And you're like, what are you talking about, yeah. man? We're barely holding our own on
yeah.
this guy.
Yeah.
He's so hopped up on PCP. I mean, literally, it's been five or six cops having to fight these guys yeah. on PCP. And it's like, you know, you don't want to – there's so much weight and pressure on these people that they're breaking their arms, their legs. But it's just they are feeling no pain. And
yeah.
they are just – they want to go at it. And it's yeah. like –
And you think nobody in their right mind would do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like anybody who tries to assault a police officer, you know you're doing jail time. So
yeah.
it's like to even put yourself in that position, it's almost like as a police officer, you would think, okay, if anybody who's really coming after me, they either have to be out of their mind or just or a violent criminal because
right.
no one would do that in their right mind. You just yeah. wouldn't because that
yeah,
would be like
the cost benefit ratio.
Yeah, it just isn't there. You know?
Absolutely.
But it's unfortunate because I think that the image should not be one of people being afraid of the police officer.
Right.
Police. It should not be that way.
Well, communities yeah. have different visions, too, right?
Yeah, so absolutely.
You called the cops. You expected the cops to come by. Cop car was, and all the kids were out in the neighborhood chasing down the cop car.
Yeah.
And the cop car came through.
Yeah.
Other communities, it's an entirely different story.
Yeah.
You know, and
but then social media has also created a problem, too, like that young man who was killed up north, the 13-year-old kid who was shot because he had a...
I
know,
like
that's what I'm saying. First of all, they should never, ever... I mean, we had BB guns when we were kids, too, but...
Kid a replica gun.
Yeah, that's pretty...
That's just stupid.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
How much does that hurt you in terms of your ability? I mean in terms of people walking around, you know, taking, you know, I mean, video, like the...
And taking pieces of video out of context.
Yeah, that's why I asked, not because you were on it.
That's a big issue for us.
Yeah.
But, like, I tell all my cops, I'm like, look, when you're out in the public and you're performing your job, you always have to assume you're being recorded, mm-hmm. either audio or video. And I said, if you guys are performing your job within the course and scope,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to have a problem. It may look ugly. Trust me, police work's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It never looks like TV. It's very, very ugly work. But I go, the reality is, yeah, you're going to be judged harshly in the public.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to court, they're going to be on your side because the justices have laid the ground rules
yeah.
on the way police work functions.
Yeah.
And, yep, you're going to get excoriated in the media, and that just sort of comes with our job now because of the electronic media that's out there. I mean,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah, and especially if there is a video of something like
yeah.
that happening. And the
you're
problem
right.
is taking out of context.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
That's the frustrating part
right.
in newsrooms is
yeah.
you see people that are more motivated to take things out of context
right.
because they know it's going to get them attention.
Absolutely.
Whereas if they contextualize it,
yeah.
it kind of the story deflates
yeah.
right away.
Yeah.
So that's
right. You know, if somebody could get a video from front to end, and they'll only put the thing about like the police officer
exactly.
punching somebody.
Yeah.
Like, this guy was unarmed and he just punched him.
Yeah.
Well, then it'll show the fact that, you know, the guy had a stick and already hit the cop a couple times.
Yeah.
You know
exactly.
what I mean? And
exactly.
he's trying to
yeah.
Alleviate the
yeah.
threat. It's like shooting incidents are real big for us.
Yeah.
It's like, well, why didn't you shoot him in the hand or the arm? It's like, well, we barely hit 50% of the time on body.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
yeah.
people
yeah.
have really weird ideas about
yeah.
shooting other human beings.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, you shoot somebody, you could kill them. And that's
yeah.
the thing. You hit them in
well,
the arm, you could kill them. If you hit them in the arm, you shoot
yeah.
them in the leg, you could kill them.
Yeah, you could, yeah. You could rupture an artery. There's a lot of ways to die.
Yeah.
But you don't have to get shot in the, you know,
yeah,
in a vital area. You could get shot somewhere else. And
even tasers are not non-lethal.
Right.
Tasers are less lethal.
Yeah.
People don't. grasp that in their
Even canines are less lethal.
Yeah, that's a beast.
My cousin's dog was I was scared to death of that dog. That dog was like he looked like if you know he would eat whole people, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what you want though. You want them that way too.
Yeah,
but let's talk about the mayor.
Let me ask one last question before we get to the mayor, if you don't mind. Because this is really kind of interesting. We were out at the Lemon Grove Gun Club out in east of Alpine a few weeks ago. Interesting group of people. You know, many of them very adamant about people should be able to, everybody should own an AK-47 and it's okay to not have them registered. And, you know, they were, you know, this, I mean, it was, it was sort of like surreal, if you would, to me, only because, I mean, I'm former military. I shot weapons. I've owned weapons. Not a big deal. I was responsible with my weapon and I, you know, I don't have one anymore, but I had it for several years when I was a little bit younger and lived in L.A. No knock on L.A. either, but. How do you deal with the idea, this reality of assault weapons and gun issues that have also made your job much more difficult because the types of weapons that are out there that you have to fight against that a lot of you are not allowed to have, but that other people can have that are a risk to you?
Well, I mean, it makes it hard for us in a sense that the criminals have a, you know, greater firepower than us, you know, to just... in easy term, but, you know, they trying to balance the right between, you know, what the Second Amendment says and what people can actually have is difficult. And, you know, we're not against reasonable regulations on firearms. Yeah. But like you said, you know, I think if machine guns are probably not a great thing to have in the hands of everybody, especially unregistered. You know, and I, you know, their point is like, well, you know what, we're allowed to have all of this stuff. But, you know, I think when it comes to that type of stuff is, you know, reasonable rules and regulations regarding firearms are not a bad thing.
Yeah. Like, I don't mind them. Like, I made a comment when we were there. I said, you know, if you want to sit out here in the middle of nowhere and in a controlled environment and leave it locked here somewhere so that if you don't get to take it home with you because you don't... The idea, if you're controlling a gun the way you're supposed to in your home, they're supposed to be the clip and the gun are supposed to be separated, right?
Yeah.
And then you're supposed to have them locked. So then by the time anybody breaks in your house to come and really get you, if they're going to get you, you do better with a baseball bat than you would trying to get to your pieces and unlock your safe and get to, if you did it the way you're supposed to do it.
Like
the problem
mythical,
is most people don't.
This mythical home intruder.
Yeah.
The whole...
Yeah.
Is an excuse to buy an AR-15.
Yeah.
Which doesn't, you know, a lot of that stuff doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're going to miss because, like you said, even cops who train and practice constantly miss because you've got adrenaline, you've got a moving target.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, it's complicated to shoot someone.
You're more likely to shoot your husband or wife than you are to shoot their neighbor or something.
Shoot through your drywall and kill your neighbor.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the thing people don't realize either, that you don't just because you shoot a bullet, the bullet goes somewhere.
Well,
that's the thing. I mean, if you're looking for a true home defense, then you know you're going to want to buy rounds that are low speed, high fragmentation. Yeah. So when they do hit the walls, that's going to be the end of them.
Yeah,
you know, and. Yeah, you mean you get the home invader, you know, I mean, if it's at night while you're sleeping, I mean, you got to wake up, get your weapon, make the assessment of what's the reality of going on.
Yeah.
And then,
and you can't do it.
No, the best thing to do is to wake up and get out of the friggin' house.
Well, no. Well, honestly, God's story. When I first moved to L.A., when I first went to UCLA, I was staying in a motel in Sepulveda in Venice for a few days waiting for my apartment. Guy climbed in my window at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm asleep. The guy puts a flashlight in my face and said, he calls me Ed. Like, he doesn't, obviously, he's just making this up. He says, Ed, is that you, Ed? Now, I'm 235-pound linebacker. Now, you know, you're trying to come to with somebody who's, like, literally from me to you with a flashlight in his face. You know, I thought I was dead. I mean, I did. I mean, and I just rolled off the bed, grabbed the entire bed, and just shoved it toward him. And just, I figured if he had a gun, he was going to shoot through somewhere. Maybe, hopefully, he would miss me. He fell out the window and took off running. They actually arrested the guy as a vagrant guy. But still, the fact scared that. I mean, that's my indoctrination to Los Angeles. But I remember thinking how vulnerable I was at that point.
Yeah.
You know, just how vulnerable you are in those situations and how I could see how even in somebody breaking your home, the chance of you being able to react so quickly is almost impossible.
Yeah.
That's what the unrealistic part is. You're really just not realistic that you can get to something unless you're, wait, I hear them downstairs in my mansion. I guess I'll have time to run and grab everything. Then we woke up.
This TV notion and this kind of delusion of how these things happen. But let's talk about the mayor's race.
All right.
So you guys had the big mayoral form.
Yes.
And that's where you made your decision. So it was the board, right? So it was the POA's board.
Right.
Everybody was there, right? So it was a packed house with POA members. But then it was the board initially that voted and gave the endorsement. Is that how it worked?
Yeah. Our process is we do we send out questionnaires to all of the candidates that are seeking our endorsement. They fill out the questionnaire. We conduct interviews with each one of them. We try to get feedback from our membership. We have a political consultant who advises us going forward. But the ultimate decision on endorsements do come, the board does, which is made up of 9 members of the police department. They're all active duty police officers. We make that decision. So
they're all elected.
They're all elected from the membership, so we try to build up relationships with the candidates over time. A lot of times when a candidate is interested in running for office, they actually contact us fairly early out before the election. And during that time, we try to meet with them as much as we can. Yeah. We try to develop a rapport. During this time, we try to research their positions and what they've stood on. For us, a lot of the stuff that's important to us is public safety related.
Yeah.
We want a strong, we want a healthy, vibrant police force because we believe that if you have a safe community, you have a vibrant, energetic community that wants to participate in the dialogue of the city. For us, because of our community-oriented policing that we're renowned for, it's very important that we also find candidates that can relate and work with the communities in San Diego.
Yeah.
Because we want a community that supports the San Diego PD and what we're trying to do is what we're looking for.
So what is it that each candidate kind of brought to the table? What was the perspective on each one?
You look at Councilmember Alvarez. You look at his background, and he's an impressive guy. I mean, this is somebody that the community should look up to because here's a guy who came from some very difficult times, went to college, and then he got elected to office, and he's working really hard for his community.
Yeah, he is.
You look at Kevin Faulkner and, the things that he's done in his life and what he's brought to the table. And, he's been in council 2 years. He's had to deal with some of the very difficult issues that have faced our police department, but I should say our city, during some very difficult times. And he's had to make some very difficult decisions. And then we had Nathan Fletcher, who we started to get to know while he was working in the assembly. He's got a lot of strong community support. We worked with him on several issues at the state level that were very important to us that we felt could have saved the city some money in the unfunded liability on the healthcare component. But those ultimately didn't materialize. But what we recognized from Nathan was the ability to, here he was a Republican, the minority party at the state legislature, and he was able to get legislation through consistently at that level, which to us really resonated with us. And here's somebody who can reach across the table, get the other side to be like, hey, you know what, these are legitimate issues and move them forward at the state level, which was very important for us. And we've continued and worked on that relationship ever since. So for us, all three, this was very unique because we have a relationship with all three of the candidates that are currently running, the major candidates that are running, even Mike Aguirre. I mean, a lot of people are like, well, you guys probably hate him. And we don't hate him. I mean, he's a very smart man.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the work that he's done. But we just disagree with some of his positions and unfortunately, we think a lot of the stuff that he's talking about now in the regarding the pensions is the city of San Diego has moved so far beyond that where we've made some reforms that needed to be done, and we're moving the city in the right direction. And then I believe the city's turning the page. Things are looking more positive nationally. I think the city's things are looking more positive locally. You know, with the approval of the expansion of the convention center, there's a lot of good stuff that can be done in the downtown. I mean, you've lived your entire life here. You've seen the difference in downtown with the way the gas lamp.
Good economy brings, you know, everything breeds from a good economy and good economic growth, even in poor neighborhoods.
Absolutely. And, you know, Comic-Con's a huge event, and it started here in San Diego. That's something that you want to keep here. And, you know, we have the craft beer industry is starting to boom here and really putting San Diego on a map. As a destination place for people that enjoy craft beer, and I think that's a huge positive for us. We have two sports teams. We got the Padres and the Chargers, and you know, the Padres were able to get a new stadium, and I'm really looking forward to you know, hopefully they get better, and I hope the new ownership has a commitment and a desire to win. When you have a winning team, I think people will in San
people
Diego
will come.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah.
You know, and as much as we support the Chargers, you know, I think it's going to be a little bit more difficult for them getting a stadium just because of all the things that we've gone through.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate because that would actually drive, that would actually, if they build it correctly and build around it correctly, they could actually generate a lot of money from a new stadium.
Absolutely.
A tremendous amount of money from the city with a new stadium.
And that's where I think, you know, if you get a multi-use stadium just outside of football that, you know, like, the college teams, the local colleges could utilize it. You
could
know,
segmentize
I mean,
it so you could either have multiple, you know, so you could soccer, you could do so much stuff with it.
Absolutely.
And there's just so much they could do. And in our location is so prime. The NFL would be here every other year for Super Bowl.
Absolutely.
I guarantee
you
if
you
we
bet.
Could do this, you know. We haven't had one since 1985, and I remember I was there. So it was like, you know, Redskins played, and they, you know, they beat the snot out of the Denver, I think it was. Doug Williams, it was a brutal beatdown.
Yeah.
But I mean, but those are the things, but those are the things when we talked about to these guys, and we've been with all three of them. I think, and that's why I like all three of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like them all as human beings.
I got a little shit for that, for us not talking to Mike. You know.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And Mike's an old family friend.
Yeah.
And my father went to law school with his brother, Gary. And Gary's probably the only guy that understands the SEC, I think, in the country. That's his thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's and Gary's totally different than Mike.
Yeah.
Gary's like this just laser beam focused kind of person, very quiet in a lot of ways, but you know, but very controlled. Whereas Mike is a lot more aggressive and a lot more gregarious. Mike's not gonna win.
No.
But he's representing a constituency that is important to him, and I think it's important for their voices to be heard, and he's going to push forward with their voice, and that's great.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he's posturing.
But he's not going to win. He's not pulling in the numbers. Yeah. He doesn't have a chance.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that there's a dark horse that could win right now. I really kind of, and I like that they're all nice guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you were saying, you know, maybe there were a few policy differences that you had with each one, but it's not like they're not, you know, you couldn't work with any of them.
No, that's very true. That's why for this endorsement is, you know, we wanted to go through the process. We wanted to vet everything that we could. And the reality is neither of the top three candidates are bad for us. Mm-hmm. And we have working relationships with all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, when it came down to that decision, you know, it was a closed session, so I can't get too much involved in it. But the reality is you have to look at the whole picture of each candidate and what we thought would be the best candidate for the city of San Diego and for the police department and public safety. And we ultimately decided that Nathan Fletcher was that person.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea? Can you hint to us what the vote split was?
Actually, the closed session meetings are 100% confidential. But you know, there was some vigorous debate. We discussed all of the candidates and what they brought to the table.
How long was the closed session?
You know, the reality is we've been having these discussions for over a month. Mm-hmm. The actual meeting itself was fairly quickly, mm-hmm. but the reality was is we'd been having these discussions and vetting this stuff for several weeks okay. before the ultimate vote.
It was a long process.
It was a very long process.
Like knee jerk, like that's my guy.
Right.
You guys didn't mm-hmm. do that at all.
Yeah, because there was a presumption out there because we had endorsed Nathan early on last year right. that we were going to go with Nathan this time. But like you said, we have relationships with right. the other two candidates, right. and we have to look at what all of them bring to the table right. and what they've done and where they're going to stand on certain issues, because we feel that we're in a very unique position and for the fact that we have a situation with our department on the recruiting and retention that needed to be seriously looked at, and we needed to evaluate each candidate on whether or not they could truly address the issues facing our police department and how they were going to fix them. Right. Those were the type of things that we were discussing. And like I said early on, you know, public safety is one of our highest priorities. We always think about how to make the community safer. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? Yeah. We took some serious cuts several years ago with the police department. How do we rebuild that? I mean, the reality is we're the eighth largest city in the United States. Yeah. We're on the ocean, and we don't even have a harbor unit.
Man, it's crazy.
And we're responsible for Mission Bay, not Harbor PD. Mm-hmm. Harbor PD can handle San Diego Bay, but they don't handle Mission Bay. We're responsible for that, but we don't even have a boat in the water.
So what do you do?
Well, the lifeguards...
Wait for them to come to shore.
Well,
at some point, they're going to have to dock, right?
No, absolutely. The lifeguards are handling some issues for us right now, and then the Coast Guard is in there. Mm-hmm. And if there's a serious issue, like some of the big weekends, you know, the 4th of July, we still have one boat left. Mm-hmm. We have some officers that are still trained. We'll put the boat in the water for that. Yeah.
Will Harbor Police help sometimes?
Yeah, if we call Mutual Aid, they'll come and help. Coast Guard will be there for sure, and then the lifeguards still have their boats. But we're a water city. We're on the ocean. Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? Chief Lansdowne had to make some very serious consideration on what were the number one priorities within the police department. Yeah. And unfortunately, the boat unit didn't make that cut.
So how do you get the city to buy into, I mean, the idea, when I look at a mayor, knowing that you're understaffed, the police department's well understaffed, how do you find someone of those three that says, look, you know what, I have the courage to do this, people may not like it, but sometimes you have to drink the green Kool-Aid anyway, even if you don't like it. Yeah. And this is something that we need. So, is there a way for the city that, you know, can this mayoral candidate or the new mayor, the next mayor, does he have the capacity to be able to push forward an agenda that gets you a boat in the damn water, that gets you the people that you need on the streets, you know, that say, hey, these are things that if we invest in now, even if we run our budget tight, if we invest in them now, that we're going to save money later. Because this is kind of the fallacy in thinking in San Diego, and I can say it because I'm from here. This sort of notion of mediocrity of saying, well, we'll just wait. It's like walking through a minefield with your ears plugged, and we'll wait till it blows up before we fix it, instead of being preemptive. And then, so you're going to wait till all your people are gone.
If you're preemptive, the mine never blows up.
Exactly. No.
So you didn't need it.
Damn it, I hate when that happens. But no, but that's the thing. That's, you know what I'm
problem,
saying? That's
right?
That's the,
when you anticipate these problems, you solve these problems.
Yeah, that's what they think. And they think we don't need it. Like, I mean, it's like
and then they don't value the solution because they didn't go through the pain of the problem.
Well, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, we have a boat unit. We got federal grants for boats. Mm-hmm. Which paid for the boats. Mm-hmm. Well, because we eliminated the boat unit, those boats had to go back to the federal government. Do you honestly believe we're going to get those boats back? No. So now the city's going to have to, when the police department gets the bodies they need to fill those positions again, they're going to have to go out and put a grant in for the federal government, which way now say, you guys didn't want the boats several years ago. Why should we give you new boats? Because you'll just give them back.
Yeah.
To us
or the boat's going
to
cost twice as much as it did when you first bought the boat, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, right?
So. Absolutely. So those are some of the things that you really have to look at. But you know, we look at public safety as a number one priority, and it's clearly stated in the charter when it comes to budgeting that police need to be a highest priority for budgeting purposes. Well, how does the police department now prioritize what its priorities are for public safety? And that's why, you know, some of these units got eliminated.
Yeah.
So whoever the next mayor is, you know, and they're really going to have to take a hard look at the way the city functions and spends its money and make those priorities. I mean, yesterday the PSNNS just approved the five-year plan. Well, that five-year plan to rebuild our police department, $63 million. It's going to go to full council next week, and you know, we have a lot of support on it. But, you know, that is only – we look at – you have to look at the police department in three components. You have personnel, you have equipment, then you have compensation. Well, the police department's responsible for the personnel and the equipment.
Okay.
That's what that five-year plan is, and the compensation falls on us as the police bargaining unit.
Okay.
You know, so – that's a huge apple. Public safety is a huge piece of every city, county, state's budget.
Yeah.
You know, we absorb a – we don't absorb. We utilize a very large component of the city's budget. So we recognize that, you know, we're a piece of the pie and there are other people fighting for their pieces of the pie. How do you prioritize those?
Right.
You know, you don't want to completely alienate or eliminate everybody at the table.
Yeah.
But the reality is sometimes you may have to give bad news. And, of course, several years ago, we got bad news that these things need to be eliminated. Public safety is going to be trimmed back. So the chief takes a look at that, and he has to prioritize internally how is he going to make our police department as efficient as possible. If you look at our department, like we were talking earlier about the East Coast versus the West Coast, we're a very thin police department management.
Yeah.
We only have 13 captains. Not even that, 12 captains. We only have like 50 plus lieutenants.
No.
We only have a few chiefs, and we only have like maybe 300 some sergeants, and the rest are all line officers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty thin.
Yeah.
Where you go to other agencies where, you know, they would probably have, you know, three times as many captains, four times as many lieutenants and sergeants. But we don't do that out here. So, you know, as we're rebuilding the department, we are going to need, you know, supervisory positions allocated in that area, too, because you want good supervision of your officers working the street.
Do you find you have to change that you'll probably also in that five-year window have to change your organizational structure as the needs sort of shift or how the department is sort of structuralized now?
Well, we just went through a the city's divided up into beats.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few years ago, we went through and we reevaluated the way we function in a beat structure, and we reorganized some of the divisions. So now if you look at the divisional maps, some of the divisions like the Western Division used to be Point Loma, Ocean Beach, Linda Vista, North Park University Heights. Well, because of the way the beat restructuring was done, the Mid-City Division now picked up North Park.
Okay.
So they could have that continuity on El Cajon Boulevard and University Avenue.
Yeah.
Could have that continuity with fell under one division.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shifted officers. Mid-City got some additional officers. I think Western, they lost some officers in the process. But we did this on a citywide scale to address those efficiencies.
Yeah.
Because what you have to look at is, you know, calls for service, types of crimes, officers out of service time, in service time, and then restructure the divisions. And I think that's good. I think police departments should do that on a regular basis just to evaluate what are our metrics?
Yeah.
Are we meeting the goals of what the community wants?
Yeah.
What are the needs of the community?
Yeah.
You know, I go to when I go to community meetings, it's sort of funny because, you know, I know like the violent crime that's happening and stuff. But when you go to these community meetings, what are they concerned about? Some car just sped down my street doing 65 and you're like, there was a triple homicide right around the corner.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was there. But, you know, these cars, they're speeding. This
is speed bumps in every, bumps in every street, you know.
Yeah, you know, so those are the things that we need to look at as a police department. You know, how do you address what the community wants? And this is where those community resource officers that we used to have and we've scaled back, they would be in tune and in touch with those people in the community going, here are the needs the community is telling us. How do we address those, plus also deal with the serious crime that's going on? I give a lot of kudos to Chief Lansdowne on the, you know, we don't have a lot of gang violence in San Diego like you see in some other large cities, is because the chief has said, you know what, I want to keep the gang units fully strength because mm-hmm. they do great work. They're yeah. able to get out there. Yeah. They keep tabs on the gangs. The gangs know it.
Yeah.
And we're able to deal with the communities who know that these gang units are still there performing their yeah. job, and they haven't been reduced.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that comes at a, you know, other investigative units, you know, pay the price in that area.
As a result, yeah.
So how does the POA see itself in relation to other labor groups, right? How would you, you know, to like SEIU, and how would you see your relationship to them and to the community, and you know what I mean, as a labor organization?
Well, I mean, you look at us in as a labor organization, we try to work on the issues that we have commonality mm-hmm. And we try to work with those. You know,
what's a common issue between like you, POA, and
Well, you know, I'm a huge advocate for defined benefit plans. I wish we could have those across the board. I know they're diminishing even in the private sector, which I think is unfortunate.
Yeah. I don't think they exist in the private sector.
Nah, there's about 31,000 companies in the U.S. that still have
defined benefit. I wonder who gives that, because I know, well, maybe it's just my industry. Because I think the last company to do defined benefits was NBC before GE went under, and then they all stopped that there.
Yeah.
And that was about 10 years ago, I want to guess that.
Yeah.
I know the paper used to have something like that.
Yeah. Boston Globe still does.
Yeah. They stopped that back in the 90s.
Yeah. Boston Globe.
I don't think locally there's any media organization.
Oh, yeah. Media, yeah. Probably not.
I mean, you know, there's some city groups, but I don't think there's a lot of in San Diego.
Now, well, you got SAIC still has DB plans. Qualcomm has a DB plan.
Yeah, the aerospace.
Larger companies. Yeah. But the good thing about California is you know, a couple years ago they actually passed a law where they're going to start to study to create defined benefit plans throughout the state of California. So it'll be like, I don't know how it's going to look, but you know, it'd be like San Diego. There would be a defined benefit plan where whatever company you worked for, they could be a part of that. So when they hired you, you as an employee in the company would put into the defined benefit plan, and it would just be your little piece.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you'd be pooling your money with a larger group of people. And what's interesting about the United States is we are a very specialized nation. So the way I try to correlate it is, you know, you go to a dentist. Because he's very specialized. He can work on your teeth. You don't do your own dental work. Mm-hmm. You don't go to your own doctor. The reality is, on average, the average person is incapable of managing their funds properly.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't even save.
Yeah.
I mean, the reports out there that show that the majority of people don't put any money away. They have less than $20,000 in their savings account for retirement.
Yeah, most people can't put anything away.
Right.
Yeah. There's
Right. It's not just the eighth largest city; it's the fourth.
Cost of living is very right. Like fourth.
Most expensive.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And they right. wages are like 28th or 30th.
The 30th.
Yeah. You know? No, I believe it.
So it's kind of impossible. So people are stuck.
Right.
It's not like they wouldn't save.
Right.
Right. When your rent is
70-80% of their income goes to just living expenses without any before you get anything else going.
Yeah. When you're looking at renting an apartment in Bonita, $1,200 one bedroom apartment in a complex at $1,200 a month.
Yeah.
And people make $24,000 a year. That means you're really taking home, you know.
Well, but when you're talking about then you get into a complicated matter. You're talking about the working poor. And that's what you're talking. Yeah. That's a whole other. I mean, that becomes a whole other kettle of fish.
The AMI in San Diego is 68, 70, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's for a family of four.
Yeah.
That's with two full-time working adults. That means two people are making $35,000 a year to live in San Diego. And even at, you know, $70,000 a year.
You can't. That's not money for San Diego.
To live in San Diego.
Not San Diego. It used to be 10, 15 years ago before the real estate.
I knew
pick
people
up. Yeah. You could live here very well for that.
$40,000 a year, and they bought a house.
Yeah.
Well, you could do that. My uncle was a carpenter.
You can, back in the mid-90s, you could buy a house here for, in the mid-90s, you could buy here for $150,000, $175,000 a year. You could get a nice house in San Diego still. But,
I had a friend who drives by this house when we were working together, and he's like, It was right on Narragansett, overlooking the ocean. Mm-hmm. He said it was like $130,000.
Wow. Yeah.
He's like, I should have bought it, but I just didn't think about it. And now it's worth like
a million bucks. Yeah, exactly. Right?
Back to like my grandfather, who essentially did my job, but at the Evening Tribune. Mm-hmm. If you're old enough to remember the Evening paper.
Yeah, of course. I used to deliver it. I used to deliver it.
My grandfather ran it. But he, he bought a house in Claremont and sent his kids to Catholic school and yep. You know, that was what you did with that job, and that was what you could expect to do that. Totally different situation now. So I think that people want to save. I don't think people are irresponsible with their money in a lot of ways.
It's just no money to spend.
I look at my 401k and I'm like, well, I got I can put.
You got a 401k? How'd you do that?
Well, exactly.
Mine's like a 101k.
It's one of the only benefits of working for massive media companies. You get this kind of stuff. But even within our company, it's things are tight. There's no more union shops within Tribune Company. Maybe New York, Chicago, but that's it.
I was thinking, what would be really handy of it? I know this is a dialogue that probably politically won't happen for some time, but. Because the way the tax base is spread out in between state, local, federal tax, and, it'd be nice because of the need locally for police officers, it'd be nice if the federal government got challenged a little bit to funnel funds back into the local economy to make sure the police force up to snuff, because if we're not relying on federal officers so much to control and maintain our city, then why can't they give us funds to be able to help maintain things that are going to help the national economy? And that helps the national economy ultimately.
Well, I point that out all the time with our federal electeds is, the border here is the busiest border in the world. Yeah. And when it comes to grants for the San Diego Police Department, because we handle the border outside of like the Border Patrol and Customs and stuff, we don't get anything. Mm-hmm. You got L.A. County just on this last go-around, I think it was it was 2011, they got $25 million to hire cops, L.A. County, and they have 9,000 sheriff's deputies. And I go...
Is it an exposure thing? Because everybody like NYPD, LAPD, those have big exposure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's part of it. I mean, you're right. L.A. got like $250 million. New York City got $400 million, mm-hmm. but... we're on a border. We've got the largest military complex.
You've got a dangerous border because just south of the border, you've got criminal cartels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So we really, if they talk about, for those who talk about border protection, beefing up our own police force to make sure that we insulate ourselves from some of that crime it comes over the border, and it comes over quite frequently.
Yeah.
That should be a venue that the federal government should be taking to task. That's why I want a mayor who's going to talk about those issues, talk to state and federal legislators and say, hey, we need to get these things in place to make sure that the citizens that are here, they feel safe in their bubble today. And this is that illusionary reality of, well, I feel okay today. Why do we need more? Because what you don't see in the other areas, do you want to wait for it to blow up? Because if it blows up, then you're going to have a problem where you really, things can go south really fast in a hurry. Is that what you really want to have? And that's what people don't want. They can't get themselves around that, and that's the unfortunate part.
You look like you remember the Boston bombing. When that went down, they were able to get like 10,000-12,000 police officers there searching that city, looking for those people. If we had a similar incident here in San Diego, to get 10,000 police officers would be incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. You'd literally have to have every police officer from every agency working in San Diego County working, which is not practical because of the shift work. And even with the mutual aid of having like L.A. come down and Orange County and stuff, it would still be very difficult where they were able to, motivate that many officers just like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah, they put them together quickly.
They did.
Is it their POA? Is that because their POAs are older and more entrenched in that
system? No, it goes back to the discussion where those agencies have a lot of police officers on their police force, where out here we don't necessarily do that.
Do you think the officers are more active within their associations? On the East Coast than they are on the West Coast?
Well,
because East Coast, I always have the notion that it's those unions.
Yeah.
We're the Wild West out here, man. Yeah. I mean, we do our own thing.
I think the unions over there are a little bit stronger than they are out here, public safety-wise, yeah, because they're established. I mean, mm-hmm. Boston Police Union, I think, is one of the oldest
in the nation.
I mean, even New York, they have very strong unions out there. I guess the mentality is maybe a little bit different too. Than if you go to Boston or New York versus San Diego, we're a lot more laid back. But I look at our community. We're relatively a safe community. I mean, we had like 38 homicides last year.
Yeah.
Go to Chicago; they had over 500.
Yeah.
You know, New York City, and but they got 10 million people living in. I don't even know how big.
It's a city.
Yeah. I mean, even here, driving around, you don't really feel that there's 1.3 million people living in this city.
Yeah. But there is a McDonald's in every corner.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, and Starbucks, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. The bonus for us, though, is that we do have a huge military complex here. So if something majorly happened, the Navy, the Marines, they would be fully active. And
now, can you mobilize? Can you contact if something happened, an emergency, could you contact and mobilize? Do you have interoperable
communication? We do training with them on a couple of things. The problem you have with the military is, they can't do too much enforcement.
Yeah.
But they're military.
They're military, exactly.
I see soldiers or Marines and sailors on the street with guns. It's a totally different situation.
Absolutely.
Than if I see a cop on the street.
That's that. If something majorly happened here, they would probably be more of a supporting force. Yeah. They could, like the LA riots.
Yeah, I was right there.
Yeah, the military there, but the military wasn't doing the actual enforcement. They were there to protect the police officers who were trying to do the enforcement.
Yeah.
And just to get people to calm down, let's step back.
Yeah, it was anarchy. I'd never seen. I mean, it was complete anarchy. And I was in the middle of my doctoral program at UCLA at the time, and I'll never forget seeing tanks come down Venice Boulevard. You know, it was just like you had to be off the streets by a certain hour. Martial law was in effect, and it was,
it was surreal.
But that's when you want to see. But see, those it's for those unexpected situations that you have to be able to prepare for, like with insurance. You buy insurance not because you hope to have a car accident, because you're trying to, make sure if you have one that you've got, you're protected. Yeah. Well, the same thing with having a police force.
When you were in those riots, did you feel comfort when you saw cops on the street?
Well, yeah, because I was, a decent upstanding.
You're studying for your doctorate.
Yeah. But strangely enough,
did that calm the neighborhood down? Did that calm the community down?
Well, it's a little bit disconcerting.
LA's a different dynamic.
What's interesting about that moment, I'll share with you, that, because people sort of associate, if you're African-American, that you must be for this side of the equation or this. And it's like I really resented that people would sort of make assertions about where you stood simply because of, the color of your skin. And that part was really frustrating, I thought. But overall, I mean, my girlfriend at the time was terrified. She was on the floor of the car screaming, like bawling like a baby because she was so terrified when they were burning down Fedco on La Cienega. I mean, literally, people were walking out of Fedco carrying, like they won the lotto. And literally, and nobody was stopping them because they couldn't. There was nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I mean, anarchy. That was an uncontrollable situation. The police department there was not, and they just said, okay, let them, don't try and engage them. Let them take, we'll find them later if we need to.
Yeah.
And actually, they came back and got a lot of those people later.
Yeah. And we sent a huge contingent up there to help out. I mean, LA called for mutual aid, so everybody was sending. But, they activated the National Guard. But just locally here, I mean, take a look at the Cedar fires. I mean, I think that's a testament on how well all the county agencies work well together because, that fire got real big real quick, but once we assessed everything, we were able to get, we had police officers who were saving houses that were recognized by neighborhoods because we had saved,
Do you think, though, that's a community thing, right? I mean, the community in LA is very different than the communities down here.
Absolutely.
Right? Do you think that the cops being able to save those homes and to be effective in those neighborhoods is the people that are here? Or is it the nature of the police force, wasn't it? You know, do you say
no, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's the relationship that we've built with the community because of the community-oriented policing. You know, we went in and we said, hey, you know what, you guys need to leave. You know, people willingly left, knowing that, you know what, we were going to make sure that we had provided the security that they wanted. But it also gave us the opportunity to go in there and, you know, the fire could only fight so many fires.
Yeah.
So whenever there was an opportunity for a police officer to step up and say, hey, you know what, if we just put some water here, this fire is not going to, is going to go around this neighborhood. These homes are going to be saved.
Yeah.
You know, they would do that, recognizing that we had the support of other law enforcement agencies who were patrolling our cities that were unaffected by the fire. So we could have all the officers, you know,
diverted to another area.
So how did you guys interpret New Orleans then? Because the fire is one kind of natural disaster. That's a different kind of natural disaster. And New Orleans seemed to be a cross between the fires and the riots in a lot of ways, right?
You know, that's a really it's a good question. I think the unfortunately the relationship with the police and the citizens in New Orleans is diametrically opposite than here. You know, so a lot of those officers were brought up on charges. There was a lot of abandonment of posts, but that came down to a lot of them was compensation. They only pay like $30,000 over there for their officers, and it was like, do I save my family or do I? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
That cops are faced with.
Yes, absolutely.
But think about San Diego, though. I mean, when I was in Del Mar, San Diego literally, other than downtown, would burn to the coast.
Yeah.
Because of somehow we couldn't get our figure out not to put accelerant trees, oil-based trees, all around half of San Diego. You think we could? Yeah, maybe we could put a different
railroad ties. That's what they were supposed to.
Yeah.
It was supposed to.
But that's really it. But that's think about. What do you do when your city will burn to the coast?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, there's right through that corridor is a fire. It's a fire trap, and you know, I mean, it'll happen again. The question is again when you talk about how you go about ensuring for protecting the infrastructure, you know, there's some things that also have to be dealt with that, unfortunately, that you have to help fire helps you, Coast Guard helps. I mean, it's there's sort of this whole compendium of groups that have to help each other, and it would be interesting to see on the political side if there's legislation or a way to be able to increase because of the border to see if there's a way to get additional funding because it's like LA gets or like New York gets, you know, when you have a border region like that. I mean, that would be a huge argument to present to try and get additional funding, which, again, I go back to the fact of the necessity of having those officers, both for community and both for
logistical challenge.
Yeah.
And you also have to pay people.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, they need to be able to afford to live in the community.
Absolutely. You know.
And I'm a big advocate. I would like all our police officers to actually live in the city of San Diego.
Yeah.
It's not a law or a rule, but per se, I think when you live in the city that you're working in, you have a vested, you're vested in it.
Yep.
You want to see it succeed and you want it to prevail. And I'm not saying that the officers that don't live in the community don't feel that same way. They definitely do. It's just you have more skin in the game when you actually live in here. It's like, you know, when the fires, I told my family, I was working, I said, grab the pictures, grab the computers, and be ready to go.
Yeah.
Because it was coming.
Yeah.
But fortunately it didn't make it there. But, you know, those are the things you start thinking about. I'm like, you know, I go, I'm working. I'm, you know, because the reality was at the time I was a supervisor and I was working. I was responsible for Ocean Beach, Point Loma, and Old Town, Midway District area. And I only had two cops working for me because everybody else was up at the fire. But surprisingly, this is what's so great about our community is there was not a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
The people were like, oh, my God, you know, I'm going to sit in my house, close the windows, I'll watch the news. There wasn't a lot of crime going on at the time.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I was running live trucks back then. That was back when I was still shooting. You know, because it was just very easy to pull up into a community and people just all of a sudden they're feeding me. I'm pressed. And random people, I'm just there to film stuff and I'll make sure I have enough water and make sure I have enough food. You know, and
that's when you get the better side of humanity at some point.
Yeah,
really, even as a police officer, it's what you want to see, too. You want to see that decent human beings are going to, you know, come to your aid, or if you need them, or more, even if you have to call it, because that's the police. You know, when you're with a ride along, by the way, if something happens with that officer and you don't help, you're in trouble. I mean, you have, you know, I mean, you can get in a lot of trouble if you don't assist an officer who's in. who's in dire straits. If you're, you know, particularly in a ride-along program, as I, and I really took that to heart. I thought that was such a great thing. I really was, I mean, really, I thought this is, you know, he's putting his life on the line. I'm here to make sure that I, you know, even as my responsibility, and even in that ride-along situation, was to make sure I did I do whatever
you guys
I need
to look internationally for other examples of systems and things that you would want to incorporate here.
Absolutely, we're. I think we're.
What's your favorite like thing you want to emulate internationally? Sandia, that you see as an example.
Well,
I don't know. You know what I mean?
You know, for me personally, I have a lot of my ancestry goes back to Germany, so I have a lot of German friends that are cops, and the one thing that's unique with them is they actually have like a federal police.
Yeah.
So
all the European countries are kind of like that.
Yeah. So what I always thought was unique was like that. You know, like my friends are there on the Dutch border, and you know, but if they wanted to transfer to Berlin, they could. Then they would become cops in Berlin, and they wouldn't lose anything for that. They would just put in a transfer.
Move, see, that's a really cool system.
Well, in France, they've got sort of two police forces, right? They've got the one police force that's the armed police, and they deal with.
Italy's the same way. They have the Carabinieri and
the gendarme, and then they've got sort of the, just the people that are unarmed, and they just deal with the community. They're the ones that walk around and give directions and things like that.
That's actually a good thing, though. I think that's a good thing, though.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've often thought, because you guys kind of get burdened with two jobs.
Right.
Because you have to be the friendly guy, but at the same time, you've got to be the guy ready to go to the mat.
Right.
Someone, whereas...
Well, that's always the funny thing, you know. It's like everybody loves a firefighter, but you know, so it's like, you know, they show up and people want to, you know, they want to hang out with them and get photographs. Yeah. We show, I mean, people want to get photographs with us and stuff, but
that's the funny thing to tell you, because I live downtown, and so I go walking through the gas lamp every now and then. And it's hilarious to me. Whenever there's a big party downtown, there are always cops getting their pictures taken. And it's just kind of always struck me as weird, because I'm like, they're working.
Yeah.
And random people are just like, let me take my picture with you.
They do.
Like they're celebrities.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, but in some ways, that's even... But even
funny.
I know, it's fun, but it's actually still a good thing. That's actually still a good
thing. They're going
with
it, and they're having fun. And, you know, and then all the people are... You could see that area just kind of... Like, the tension just sort of deflates right there, because... That cop was goofy and made everyone laugh.
Well, it was like, you know, during the Mardi Gras, when I don't work too much overtime anymore, but when I was working, like, Mardi Gras was a big event here, and it was like, well, you know, what's our policy? Because people are going to give us beads.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, the chief was like, you know what? If they give you beads, wear the beads. Be cool.
You know what?
We want everybody to have a good time, but we want everybody to be safe.
Yeah.
If you see stuff, take care of it. Yeah, that type of
stuff. But you want to have a presence, but fit in. You know, fit in as much as you can reasonably fit in.
So, you know, by the time the event was over, I think I had, you know, a good stack of beads on me. You know, and I'm like,
you didn't even have to lift your vest.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? So it was one of those things where, you know, people recognize that we're people too.
Yeah.
We're there to make sure that they have a safe time.
Yeah.
You know, but we're not these grumpy guys running around going, you know, do this, don't do that. You know, you're drinking too much.
Yeah,
you know?
But that image, I think, is made the POA and the cops more, more of a force politically too, right? Because you've been able to relate to the people who are here. So I think that's, because in a lot of places you would, you know, like, and I always go back to LA, it seems to be a lot more adversarial there between voters and citizens and then the police force. There.
Right.
Whereas here it doesn't... There's some of that, but it doesn't seem to be nearly at the level it is in other communities.
Yeah.
And it gives you more power, too.
Right. Well, yeah, because we want to work with the community. I, you know, as the, you know, the president of the police union, it's like I want to know what the community wants, because that gives me ability to go to the elected officials and go, look, I'm not just coming to you from what my cops need, but here's what I'm hearing in the community and what they need.
Yeah.
And these are the things that... need to be addressed. Yeah. And what I hear from the community is they do want more police officers. Yeah. They think we're a little bit thin. We're holding our own right now. Mm-hmm. We're keeping crime down. But the fact is, there was a... When you had the amount of officers we needed to deal with the community-oriented issues, people like that. They want a cop to be able to be at their community meeting. Yeah. They want a cop to answer their questions about... Here's what I'm dealing with in my community. What are you doing to fix that?
When we talked to Alvarez, he hinted at a lot of that and how that is really what changed Barrio Logan for him growing up, because he grew up there in, what, the 80s, 90s. And he saw that evolution over his lifetime, because it used to be a lot more dangerous, and now it's calmed down a lot, considering. You know, and so do you think that? I mean, do you think his background is going to? How is that going to color his relationship with the POA and the police force?
You know, I think if he becomes the mayor, I think his focus will be the neighborhoods. And, you know, I think his goal will be to try to recruit people out of those neighborhoods to be on the police force.
Do you think he's willing to put money there? Do you think he's willing to push for more money?
That's going to be the tough issue, because one of our issues that we have, and you brought up the thing about working with the other bargaining units and the unions. I mean, like I said, we want to work on issues that are mutually beneficial and that we have in common. But what happens a lot is you run into this Me Too clause, or everybody needs to be treated equal. But the reality is, we have a unique situation facing our police department in the fact that 900 of us can retire in the next 4 years. That's a serious issue. We're not asking for the whole pie. We're just asking for the city to make a commitment to the police department that public safety is a high priority, and we're going to move in that direction. And when you do that, and because of the needs that our department needs, it can't be spread equally across all everybody. And that's a big issue for us, because...
Well, equal isn't fair always, right?
Right.
I mean, fair and equal are two different things.
That's well said. That's a very key point. Yeah, absolutely.
People misunderstand that. It's the same, just because my father, I remember being a kid, my sister's short. She's like 5'2", if in heels, right? And I remember my father always saying to me, well, you know, you can't see, because we'd go someplace, and I could see, but she couldn't see. And so he'd pick her up, and I'd be like, she's short. You can see this is fair, you know, and that's how they and I think people misunderstand that.
Exactly.
You know, it'll be interesting to see. I'm excited about this election, and I haven't been really excited about a local mayoral election.
I'll be glad when it's over.
I know. I believe me. I feel you there.
It won't be over. We'll have a runoff.
I know.
Well, it'll be interesting, because it's like, are their voters going to show up? Because nobody's looking for new voters, right? They're all looking for their voters to come out in numbers.
I mean,
if Alvarez can mobilize the Hispanic vote, which is like this mythical dream, to mobilize the Hispanic vote in that way, he could win. Faulkner's people, they vote. Republicans,
they'll vote.
You know, they vote. People in Claremont, they show up and they vote all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Fletcher, will his, because he's hitting that 35 to 55 area. I'm really curious to see if those, that group.
The thing is, either way, with all three of them, you really don't lose with any of them. You may get a little bit more of one than the other, but it's the kind of thing you go, worst case scenarios, I can work with any of these guys, because you just feel like they all want to do a good job, and they all want to make this a stepping stone to maybe being the next mayor again next time around, or running against probably Todd Gloria, you know.
That's why we took a step back.
Okay.
I think Todd wants Congress more than he wants to be. More than he wants to be mayor.
You know, and that's why we had to take a step back and evaluate everything that was presented to us, because
you want relationships with all three of them, in case, because you have to play whoever happens to step through.
Either way, you kind of end up having to work with all three of them.
Absolutely.
Right? Faulkner's still city council.
Absolutely. Yeah. They still are,
And Alvarez, too, if he's, either of us are all, so.
Right.
It's not like you can be mean. But they're not that kind of people.
Right.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
Absolutely, man.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
Pleasure. That was a pleasure, man.
Yeah.